Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. Thanks for coming. I'm Dan Garfield. I'll be moderating this afternoon's discussion. I've got my little spiel here. Thank you to the Harry H. Baron Trust and Rabbi Zev Baron for its continuous sponsorship of Torah for Tycoons, which is celebrating its bar mitzvah year, its 13th year. Throughout the past 12 years, the Kollel has brought the Torah perspectives on business and personal ethics to well over 500 people through this program. Next speaker talk will be Wednesday, January 4th. We'll focus on the responsibility of a property owner for assets. And will be presented by Arthur Kutzer, Managing Partner, Center Goldfarb & Rice, and Rabbi Rice, Senior Educator for the Denver Community Kollel. Some of you may have heard about our recently launched capital campaign as the Kollel embarks on creating infrastructure in multiple locations across Denver. If you'd like more information and for dedication opportunities, please speak to a Kollel rabbi following the class. The Kollel's annual Jewish family extravaganza will take place as every year on December 25th at the South Suburban Sports Center in Centennial. More information, more info on cost and reservations, please contact the Kollel at info@denverkollel.org. Lastly, save the date, January 11th at 6:30 p.m. for the Kollel Women's Division annual Women's Wellness Workshop. If you missed past T4T classes, you may want to listen to recordings. You can find them on the Kollel's website at www.denverkollel.org. You can also find the latest info on Kollel programming and archive classes on many topics on the website. I'd like to introduce today's presenters, Rabbi Kamlet, Managing Partner of Kamlet LLP, and Rabbi Mordechai Fleischer, Senior Educator for the Kollel. Jay, take it away.
Thanks for coming out in this brutal cold weather that we're just not used to. We're here to talk about the existence of corporations or an entity outside of individuals that have been authorized. I'm talking about it from a common law perspective, and Rabbi Fleisch will be talking about it from a halachic perspective. So as I look back in my law books, I found the original corporation that was established by the Crown was in 1600, the British East India Company. And that was a group of merchants who were authorized by the Crown to be the exclusive distributors and merchants with the East Indian countries. Since then, corporations have become much more a mainstay in the British and American business culture. But essentially, if you break down a corporation, it's a group of stakeholders that are authorized to act as a single entity. Those stakeholders include the shareholders who own the stock of the company, the directors who are put on the board at the whim of the shareholders, at the will of the shareholders, the officers who are often hired by the directors, and then the employees and agents of the corporation that are hired by the officers. So you have this chain of command, starting really with the shareholder who hopes to put on their sympathetic cronies onto the board so that they, while they can't pull the strings themselves, unless they're also a board member, they can have themselves a tight group of comrades helping them direct the direction of the company. Now, over the years, so we've seen that the attributes of the corporation are typically centralized management and limiting shareholders' liabilities. So, in the event a corporation is found guilty for doing something, whether civilly or criminally, the shareholders are usually immune to action. That doesn't always apply to the directors and officers and employees that are affecting the company, because while corporations have been imbued with the idea of personhood for most everything that we consider sacred to humans, they really can't act but through their agents. We see, however, that sometimes a corporation can't protect everybody. My first recollection of a disaster caused by a corporation was back in 1984 from the Union Carbide Bhopal Indian disaster, where about 500,000 impoverished Indians were subjected to methylene gas by a spill at the Union Carbide plant. The Indian government, well, I'm not sure if they were ever successful in doing so, did find the CEO, the chairman of the board, and several employees guilty of criminal misconduct for causing this spill. They did seek to imprison those employees and officers and directors, as well as fine them, but I'm not sure if they were ever extradited to India to serve out their sentence. We certainly have experienced in the 90s and the early 2000s the Enron scandal, where you had the famous Ken Lay and I think it was Jeff Skilling, who were found guilty of manipulating the utilities markets in California and causing a lot of disruption to the markets. I think they took down Arthur Andersen as an entity as well. Through that scandal, but they did actually spend time in jail. Then you had Quest's CEO, who was found guilty for insider trading. I think I can't remember his name, Antonucci or something like that. So yes, corporations have been treated as for lack of a better word, live entities for almost everything. There are some restrictions on corporations. Corporations still can't give donations to candidates for federal office. However, in a recent case in the last 5 years called Citizens United, corporations have been found to have First Amendment rights to free speech, which is what accounts for all those ads during the last few elections that cannot directly name a candidate, but can talk about issues in a way that certainly you know which candidate the issue campaign is pushing you to vote for. Last week or 2 weeks ago, and this will come into the discussion, this will be a segue to the rabbi's discussion, there was a criminal penalty imposed against Princess Cruise Lines. There were several instances over the last 8 years where crew members were bypassing their waste disposal methods that were supposed to clean the waste before it was put back into the waters they were sailing in, and somehow they rigged it to where the waste was bypassing their system and flowing directly into the waters the boats were sailing in. Interesting thing is the Princess Cruise Lines, primarily owned by Carnival Cruise Lines, which was founded by an Israeli, Ted Arison, and it was very dedicated to Israel. He passed away and passed most of the holdings of the Carnival Cruise Lines to his family, primarily run by his daughter, Shari Aronson, who, again, as a shareholder and director of Carnival Cruise Lines, ultimately directs the policies of the Princess Cruise Lines. So we have a situation where the Princess Cruise Lines were found guilty of a felony for these actions. They were fined $40 million for that. There was nobody held that I know of, or at least hasn't been reported, to be put in jail for those actions, but there's certainly the employees that were doing it were certainly found guilty as well. So that all leaves us with this dilemma of when you have this corporate entity which is really being directed through the actions and policies of its stakeholders, you really can't throw a corporation into jail, but you're still imbuing this with all these characteristics of a human being: freedom of speech, ability to perform criminal as well as civil acts. Again, most of those come in the form of fines and penalties, but how do you really hold a corporation accountable? So that's the dilemma that's addressed by the Torah law that Rabbi Fleischer will be discussing today.
Thank you very much, Jay. So, as Jay pointed out, there are a few different issues we have to try to flesh out over here. I think the very first issue is, what we have to try to figure out is, does the Torah recognize the idea of a corporation being an independent entity, whether or not it has personhood, follow on the heels of that question. So the very first question you have to ask is, this idea called as being an independent entity, not necessarily the sum of its parts of the shareholders, but rather a new item which the shareholders may have stakes in, but is not regarded as just being a collective of shareholders, would the Torah recognize that? And I think that's the first question we have to focus on, and then we could move forward from there and try and figure out practically how that would bear out and what the practical ramifications would be. Just one disclaimer over here that I do want to point out before I get involved in the discussion, that the idea of Dina de Malchus Dina, the law of the land is law, which is a very prominent idea in Torah law, to a large degree could throw the whole discussion off kilter, just because you have to start figuring out where the law of the land would prevail in terms of recognizing the law of the land, in which situations it would not. Doesn't always hold sway, sometimes it does. So what I'm going to try to do is just circumvent that whole discussion, talk about, let's just assume there is no real law of the land. We're talking about this kind of in a vacuum, or let's just say in a state run according to Torah law, what would the halacha be? Okay, and we'll try maybe to see practically, as Jay mentioned, with the case of Carnival Cruises, how would that play out practically, perhaps in American law as well. If we have a few minutes, we'll try to get to that. So if you look at source number one, and I'll ask you to put your thinking caps on, because we're going to get to some ideas today that maybe are a little bit out of the box, or out of perhaps our normal realm of thinking, and some eyebrow-raising material, but when you see it, you'll see that a lot of it makes a lot of sense, just not perhaps the way we're accustomed to looking at things. Source number one is a quote from the Minchas Yitzchak. Minchas Yitzchak was a fairly contemporary Torah authority by the name of Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss. He lived in England for many years, later emigrated to the land of Israel, and he has a lengthy discussion on the status of corporations. And I obviously did not bring down all, I think it's 8 or 9 pages worth of his discussion, but just a quote over here. He says, I've seen the name of Rabbi Yosef Rosen. Rabbi Yosef Rosen lived in the town of Dvinsk in, I believe, Western Russia during the early 20th century. And he was known as a genius of an individual, but he says that I have seen the name of Rabbi Yosef Rosen, who debated regarding the status of a public. Okay, what he means by a public here is that, is there an entity called a public? As he says, if it is simply the whole of the many individuals, then it's not changed at all. In other words, if you look at a public, let's just say you have a synagogue. It's a public synagogue. It's owned by the entire community. So is it owned by every single individual in the community? In which case, it's just a partnership of all the people in the community. Or, through their partnership together, the actual status has changed. Does it create this new thing called public? Does the coming together of the entire community in an ownership of one item create a new entity called held by the public, where I don't have my own personal ownership, my own personal stake in the synagogue? It's owned by the public, and I'm part of the public, so by extension, I have a right, and I may have a part of that synagogue, but it doesn't necessarily, you can't say, I, Mordechai Fleischer, am a stakeholder, and I can't say I'm an owner of that synagogue. And that's a question that he debates. He brings down a fascinating source. I'll just try to share with you briefly. Fascinating source. Many of you know that there was an obligation in temple times, some still have the custom today, to give a shekel, a half shekel every year towards the cost of the sacrifices in the temple. Okay? And there was a debate in the Talmud about whether or not the Kohanim, the priestly class, had to give this shekel or not, this half shekel. And one of the arguments was that one of the sacrifices brought in the temple, it's the laws of how the sacrifice is brought differ if it's coming from a Kohen a priest or from a non-Kohen. Okay? And so they argued, if you bring the sacrifice and we contribute our half shekels, then you get stuck between a rock and a hard place because you can't fulfill the laws, the conditions of offering this particular sacrifice. You've got non-Kohanim with this set of laws, and you've got Kohanim as owners with this set of laws. There's no way to offer that sacrifice and fulfill all the conditions. And so they therefore said, we'd best stay out and just not give our half shekel at all because you're going to run into trouble. Okay? And there's a debate about that in the Talmud. And the Talmud says, no, you have to give the shekel anyways. And Rabbi Rosen wants to argue the reason why they would have to give a half shekel, it's going to be the wrong law. The laws of the coin sacrifice differ. So he wants to say, based on this, this is not a sacrifice of non-priests and priests. It's a sacrifice of the public. The public doesn't recognize the individuals who are making it up. That's the proof he wants to bring, that in fact there is this entity called public, which is not comprised of the many individuals who make it up. Okay? And based on that, one could perhaps now, by extension, take the argument and say, well, we create this new entity called corporation. And corporation would not be the many individuals who make it up, but it's a new entity called corporation. So that is the possibility that comes up based on this argument of Rabbi Rosen. If you look at source number two, another prominent Torah authority quoted again by Rabbi Weiss. The name of this authority is Rabbi Shaul Weingarten. He was a Rosh Yeshiva, a dean of the school in Montreux, Switzerland. And he said he wants to again entertain the following possibility. If we can define as follows, the ownership of the owners of the shares. I apologize for the occasional wordiness. It's translated as accurately but as possible while getting over the ideas that they're expressing. The ownership of the owners of the shares is not individualistic. That is tied to the owner. Rather, it is the totality of the assets that are part of the corporation. And it is these assets it is as if these assets are a legal entity. And in truth, this is the legal structure of Aktiengesellschaft. Anyone ever heard of that? Don't everyone raise your hands at once. What? That's a German term, exactly. For corporation, yes. According to Wikipedia, it means shares corporation. The word Aktiengesellschaft, it means shares, and Gesellschaft means corporation. Okay? And so that is the word he quotes. I checked it up. That's what I came out with, so I figured we'll just throw it in there. Aktiengesellschaft in modern legal terms. Okay? Corporation. But the question remains, if such a concept was known, meaning was it accepted, to the sages of the Talmud. It's a very nice idea, but does the Talmud go for it or not? Okay. And as we'll see shortly, even if you agree with the idea of a public, the idea of a public is everyone together in a community. Does that extend to a bunch of businessmen or individuals banding together to create a business entity, which is not the entire community? Okay, it's whoever owns shares, whoever owns stock in that company. Okay? So these are some of the ideas that are put forth, which brings us to source number three. Rabbi Weiss himself disagrees with the whole position, and he says no. He says you cannot create a corporation as an independent entity. He has a lot of discussion about whether the idea of the public holds water or not, but he says even if that's true for a public, you can't necessarily extend that to say that a bunch of individuals can come together and create a new entity when they're not the public, they're just whoever owns stock in the company. And so he posits, in source number three, what emerges from all this is that individuals in public assets have the status of ownership. They do have the status of ownership, and by extension, surely it can be said as such for the shareholders regarding the assets of a corporation. Okay, so he says public assets, they're owners of public assets. Certainly, in a corporation, which is not public, it's publicly traded, but it's not owned by the entire public, those certainly would have a status of regular, normal ownership, and they would be the owners in the company as partners in the company, and you would not look at this as an independent entity. That is what Rabbi Weiss posits, but he says, if you look at source number four, he continues, and he says, a limited ownership is still ownership according to Torah law, and therefore, standard shares, what he means is a limited ownership. What does it mean a limited ownership? Because if I own shares in a company, I have very little control over that company's policies. Right?
If you're a small shareholder.
If I'm a small shareholder. Okay,
Limited ownership
in his meaning, as Dan points out, if I'm a small shareholder, correct me if I'm wrong, but even if you're a large shareholder, you don't have all the rights of an owner, you still have limitations on what you can do.
Yeah.
Well, because you can only affect so much influence over the board of directors with shares.
Majority of the shares, it's a different story. Yeah.
So he's really not talking about that case. More about that scenario a little bit later. But he's saying that if it's limited, that's still called ownership, and therefore standard shares where there is some limited ownership for the share owners, that's legal ownership. But those shares when they have no say at all, which I think for your average corporation is not true, they have inevitably some sort of say, something. They have some sort of say in the voting rights and so on. But if they have nothing at all, and not even to express their opinions at the meetings of the corporation that occur periodically, in this case it can be said that it is not even limited ownership and it is regarded as a loan. Okay? What? So
it's debt instead of equity.
Right. And that's what he seems to be saying. Anyone want to jump down my throat before I continue?
How can that be a loan? The company goes out of business.
But again, in modern corporate, there are preferred shares that are kind of a hybrid of a loan and equity as well. That if there's a liquidation, you get a preferred return. If there's a liquidation, you pay the debt first, then the preferred shareholders, and then the regular share. So there are those instruments. Correct. Again, that's just, again, modern construct of this.
So if you have a Jewish corporation that's considered a loan, how can they pay dividends?
That's a problem. That's true. You're right. That's true. And just to respond to what Sandy and what Adam are saying, you're absolutely correct. That was my disclaimer. We're talking about what would the status of a corporation be when in a state governed by Torah law. You're absolutely correct. In other words, practically speaking, you're going to some degree abide by the law of the land, and consequently, most of the time, you're not dealing certainly with Jewish owners, depends on the corporation, but assuming that it's just a regular corporation in secular America, you're gonna deal with it on their terms. Where it gets stickier is, let's say, you go back to Carnival, where it's Jewish owners, that's where life gets more interesting. Let's just assume for a minute they're Torah-observant individuals, and you're going to drag them off to a Jewish bezdin somewhere. Then what's going to happen? So they owe me money. They took my money and they threw it overboard, quite literally in this case. And, do they owe me the money? Am I beholden to their decisions? Is it a debt? Is it a loan? How does that work? That's where life would get very interesting in terms of how that would be regarded. Okay, now again, he's saying that you have to have absolutely no power whatsoever. Okay, no say whatsoever. And I think any corporation, if you're a shareholder, again, correct me if I'm mistaken, you have some degree, something. You have voting rights, or you're allowed to express your opinions, or
what would be considered any significant sway on the company? If I own two shares in Apple.
You still vote.
But
you could still vote. You still have something.
It's almost as much me deciding who's the president.
Well, let's say you have the power to
hold. Have a choice there.
Let's say you have the power as those two shareholders, two shares, to bring in people to give you their proxy for their shares, because you bought those shares so that you could bring this, an issue to the forefront, whether it's an environmental issue. I mean, there are a lot of shareholder activists. That are trying to amalgamate their small shareholding by bringing in proxies from other shareholders to then affect the change on the board or direction of the company.
As a practical matter, would a baked in assert jurisdiction over a Jewish corporation in America?
I can't speak for the Bezdin. I think
it's in Colorado, that's a question under OPEC against OPEC. Right? That's the OPEC case was, by OPEC, it was in a had an agreement, a prenuptial agreement.
That's not a corporation.
Well, but it's the same thing. I mean, can you
lost
yourself out of the law of the land?
Yeah. The corporation is a creature of the state. Yeah. You have to go register the Secretary of State for creating a corporation.
If you were a close corporation, and everybody agreed in your close corporation to be bound by a faith.
Amongst the shareholders, yes.
Oh, you could.
That's their body.
Yeah, you could. You could. There is an idea, again, maybe it's what you're alluding to, and then I'll move on. But where, you know, different parties can agree to go to a Beis Din, and I think legally that's looked at as arbitration and becomes binding. Yeah, but I think what Danny is asking is can you summon them? Yeah, I would think theoretically. You know, again, then the Beis Din would have to determine whether law of the land holds sway in this case and creates that. We'll see more as we move along that some authorities would seem to indicate, or at least based on their words, one could conclude that the law of the land would allow the corporation to be recognized because you're doing it on those terms. You know what you're getting yourself into. We'll see more. Others are going to maybe not be as clear about that. We'll try to move on.
I just want to point out, we did a tour of Tycoons a long time ago about this, you know, the Beis Din versus the state law. We did it, and it's fascinating, actually, that basically the halakha is that when you have two Jewish parties, that they need to process it in a Beis Din. In a practical sense, most often it ends up not coming to final a lot, unless you have complete willing parties. If both want to resolve it in Beis Din, it's going to end up in the court, and that's going to be a halakhic process as well. And so, because we're in an environment where the halakhic Beis Din can't enforce anything, so but the first thing is that first goes to Beis Din, and then they'll write a paper that will release the process to go to the court. So it would apply the same as these corporations as individuals. That's the way it would work. First, if you have two willing parties to do it in court, and then the law will recognize the court as arbitration, the legal system will allow this to be a binding, and then the Beis Din will process it. If they can't come to a resolution, if they can't enforce it in the society, it will go back to that.
Well, typically what would happen is they would come to a resolution, but they can't enforce it. So the party then files the arbitration award in court, and then the civil courts will enforce it.
Yes.
My question was more, can you summon a cruise line into...
Practically, it's not happening.
He wants to know, I think, theoretically.
It's not a Jew. I mean, it might be a person, but I think personhood stops at religion, although...
Oh, so what they're saying...
Well, I guess some people are Christians.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, again, we're not. Once you say that we don't recognize the corporation, that Torah law would not recognize the corporation, but rather would recognize the owners as partners in a regular partnership, so then you're gonna schlep those owners. Theoretically, if it's a publicly traded company, there's a lot of people walking into the court. I don't know. You'd have a pretty packed courthouse. I imagine that you would have, a representative there or something to that effect. But yeah, it would be a partnership of potentially many people. Right? Bearing in mind also that corporations are not limited to publicly traded. You can have closed corporations where, Goldberg and Sons, something like that, where you just have a few people who are Hamlet LLP. It's a small group of
partnership. I have to. I'm two people.
You're two people.
I have a dual personality. So
okay. Which one is here today?
Just think about it.
All right. So sorry. That is Rabbi Weiss's position. Okay. That brings us to another fascinating approach, and that is that of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Again, another one of the major, major Torah authorities and halachic authorities, passed away in 1986, who ruled on many, many of the major contemporary issues that came up in America and moving into modern, more modern society. So he wants to posit the following in source number 5, and he says, those who purchase shares, now he says there are very small amounts of business being offered. So he's discussing a shareholder who's owning a relatively small portion of the company. And they have no opinion in the business, even in regards to their shares, cannot be considered owners. Nor does the one who purchased shares want to be an owner in the business, nor does he want to purchase any part of the business. Rather, he is only like one who purchases the rights to the profits and losses that will occur to the business. Okay? So he's not an owner, he has purchased the rights to the profits, and obviously taking on the risk of the loss, in proportion with the amounts he has purchased. In other words, he has the profits and the losses in proportion to how much he has purchased of it. Now, he does continue. I didn't quote it over here. It's a bit lengthy. But he continues and he says, you're going to tell me, no, he's an owner. He's able to vote for the president of the company and so on and so forth. He says, I'll say the Hebrew term, that's pitume mili. Pitume mili means kind of like I'm tossing you a bone to make you feel good. We'll let you vote for the president and so on. But really, you have very little or no power. Okay, and the fact that you have some very limited rights as a small shareholder does not give you a status of ownership, even though you have some very limited power in the company. And you're right, you could theoretically create a whole block of proxies by owning just two shares. I don't know what he would say then. I did speak to an expert in this field in Lakewood, New Jersey yesterday, and he commented to me that he got a phone call recently from a very well-to-do individual who was a member of a very well-to-do family, Torah observant family in America, and they are buying, I think it's only 30% of a particular publicly traded corporation, company. And now they had all sorts of questions about what their status is in that company. Okay, in terms of, are they owners? And if they're owners, if this corporation conducts business on Shabbos, is that a problem? If the business is involved in dealings that are problematic according to Torah law, owning chametz, leavened bread on Passover, dealing in perhaps non-kosher or meat and milk items, so on and so forth, all these kinds of questions come up. And Rabbi Feinstein is addressing this question, and as Sandy pointed out with the question of dividends, you run into problems of if you're a bank, can you lend money with interest if you own stock in that company? So Rabbi Feinstein is coming to say, if you're a small shareholder, that you're not an owner. That's not an issue. Once you have a significant amount where you have some control, that's even Rabbi Feinstein would certainly agree there that you have the status of an owner of the corporation. But again, he's not agreeing to the notion of the corporation being an independent entity. He's just questioning whether you as a small shareholder are an owner at all. There is a partnership over here, but the partnership is comprised of those who have significant holdings in the company and therefore by extension are regarded as owners. If you own two shares or 200 shares, whatever, a small amount, where you don't really have any real control, yes, there's a partnership. You're not one of the partners, though. That's what Rabbi Feinstein is positing.
What if you have corporations, like, say, General Electric, which is made up of a bunch of smaller owners that nobody really has any significant control? Is nobody considered an owner in that instance?
I'm not sure. I don't know what would be in that case. If no one has control at all, who would be the owner?
General Electric's been around for 100 years. It seems surprising that anybody would own that much of it. I mean, I don't know. But I mean, it seems impossible.
Mr.
Vodka doesn't own that one, does he? So effectively, have control of a public corporation, you need about 20% of the shares. I think the IRS is kind of doing that. It's kind of what it does. But then you can control the board of directors. You can get other people to join with you that are on your side to have the shares. You have 20%. It's about 20 to 30%.
That's as far as control. Right. What Dan is asking is what will be if no one has control whatsoever. I'm just curious how would that work? Who makes the decision?
Well, the shareholder would vote. It's just that nobody has owns a high enough percentage that they would be considered to have significant control.
So it's a democracy.
The way people set these things up, they set it up so when they have their corporations, that the management is going to have control. Appoint board of directors. They have groups of people that they own enough shares.
Yeah, in general.
So that they're going to keep their
jobs. Not in general, actually. Right, so that's what he's pointing out, that's true in general, but I'll just say the bad joke again. It's true in general, but not in the case of General Electric. So, he's saying that's not the case. I'm not sure then, if no one has control, if you would like you say, it's a democracy. going back just to source number four for a moment, where he talks about if you have no control at all, you wouldn't be an owner, Rabbi Weiss's point. The proof he brings to that, he gives a case, maybe this is somewhat similar, it's not exactly the same. He talks about where you have a government that issues what he calls banknotes. It's not clear exactly what he means, but if I own those banknotes, so he seems to understand that somehow I have a share in the government, something to that effect. So if you have a bank that issues banknotes, we said, would that then make me an owner in the corporation? I have no say whatsoever. He makes an argument. So there, if you let's say have a democracy, and you have everyone being part of that democracy, would they be considered owners in the entire country, in the entire government? We have a representative government. So are we all owners of the United States? That's, I mean, we are going to get saddled. We are being saddled at some point with trillions and trillions of dollars of debt. But, what? It's your grandkids, and then their grandkids, or their grandkids, yeah. The book's got his stuff somewhere. Okay, so that is Rabbi Feinstein's approach. Now, here is the next approach is that of Rabbi Moshe Sternbach, who is a contemporary scholar. He lives in the land of Israel, actually originally came from England, later lived in South Africa, and he is one of the very prominent Torah authorities, halachic authorities today. And he makes the following point. He says, they want, according to the laws, to have a new creation. And he's talking about the idea of the possibility of a corporation to have a new creation, but we have no such concept, according to Torah law, in monetary matters. Nor is it possible to make it. For our monetary laws are limited to giving monetary rights to a live person only. A dead person, even if one wanted to make a law, cannot have any monetary acquisition at all. Halacha says that a dead person cannot acquire anything. You can't give something, you can't transfer ownership of an item to a non-living person. Okay, and therefore he says by extension, a corporation is not a live person. Okay, so it's tantamount to a dead person. Halacha only recognizes acquisitions by live people. And if a corporation is not a live person, here's where the person with the question really, rears its head very clearly, it's not a person. It's not a live person. Even a dead person you can't do anything with. Certainly a non-person at all. You can't create it. And so he rejects even the notion of law of the land working for this, because the law of the land will say, law of the land will determine how halacha will view certain terms and conditions. Law of the land can allow certain terms and conditions to apply to transactions because of the laws that are in place. Law of the land cannot create the ability of an acquisition where Torah doesn't recognize any ability of acquisition to take place at all. It's just not possible. It's not possible. Law of the land will not allow ex nihilo to something from nothing to exist. It can create parameters of how something operates, but it can't create something from nothing. And his argument is over here, if acquisition requires a live person by definition, so then the whole idea of a corporation cannot exist in halacha, despite the fact that there are laws in place that would recognize it. Okay? And therefore he continues and he says, for us, only a partnership with specific terms is possible, meaning you want to create a partnership. And within the partnership, you can set up terms whereby the individual who are part of the partnership themselves are personally indemnified against their own personal property being beholden to the corporation. If those are the terms and conditions, that's fine, because that's how you set up the partnership. So if 10 people get together and make a partnership, and the terms of the partnership are that only the monies, the assets put into the partnership can be liable for anything, but the personal property is not there. If I borrow money from them, if I do business with them, et cetera, I'm doing it on those terms of the partnership. And so therefore I wouldn't be able to collect any debts from the personal property of any of the partners because I set up a partnership in that fashion. That's fine. But he says this idea of a corporation wouldn't work. And he continues and says, therefore the money received for shares in the corporation is, according to Torah law, a loan given to the directors of the corporation. Now, why the directors, I'm not clear. I guess because they're the ones running the company. Okay? But he wants to argue that if I buy shares in the company, according to Torah law, I've simply lent money to the directors who are running the company who took my money from me. Okay? Okay, that would be the status, because halacha cannot and will not recognize a corporation. You can't have ownership in something which doesn't exist, and therefore it's not just not possible ownership, it's simply a loan, and you've given money to the directors, I guess, to invest in your behalf. Okay, that is the argument he wants to make, and he continues. And he says, yes, if the money was lost, then they would have to, according to Torah law, they'd have to pay it back. So if you drag them to Beis Din, to the Jewish court of law, they would have to pay the money back. Okay, that is the approach taken by Rabbi Moshe Sternbach. I think really that's the sharpest approach of the three, of the four that we've seen over here. Okay, because we have now, right now, if you stop and think a moment, you have four different possibilities. You have the very first possibility we talked about, that a corporation is this new entity similar to a public. A public is an independent entity, and a corporation perhaps is an independent entity. That seems to be rejected by most of the major authorities. You have Rabbi Weiss' approach that it's simply a partnership, and you're an owner. As long as you have some degree of control, any amount of something, anything, any right, even just a voting right, that makes you an owner. You have Rabbi Feinstein's approach that because you have very limited control, you're not an owner, you're just buying the rights. But if you have control, then you would be an owner. And you have the approach of Rabbi Sternbach, who says the holding doesn't exist in the first place. It's nothing. You're not an owner because there's nothing to own. You just lent money to the directors. Okay? That is the approach that he takes. Okay? Any questions before I move on? Fun silence. Okay. So that brings us to source number 7. Again, this is just an extension of the idea just expressed before. Going back to Rabbi Moshe Feinstein over here in a different response, he says, he's talking about the following question. Am I allowed to open a bank account with a bank that is Jewish owned? What's the problem? If I open up a savings account, they're going to give me these days a very, very, very small interest rate on my savings account. The Torah prohibits usury. So am I allowed to open the account and get interest on that money? That's the question that he's addressing. And he rules, and this is a controversial ruling, but he rules that in fact you are allowed as an individual to open the bank account. And he says that even though there's a problem of interest, that's for a standard loan that makes an obligation upon the person of the borrower. This obligation is placed upon him, and he, the borrower, is called a wicked person if he does not fulfill his obligation to pay back the debt. Let me just explain what he means over here. Okay? Aside from, when you borrow money, according to Torah law, you incur an obligation to pay the money back. The way that the technical structure of that obligation is that I, as a person, have an obligation upon my head, upon what you might call my person, in Hebrew word is my guf, my body literally, to pay back that money. Okay? Because that obligation is upon my person, it extends to my assets, my properties as well. So if the borrower fails to pay back the loan, then the creditor may have recourse to seize his assets, his properties, etc., etc. Okay? But it all starts from the debt placed upon me, the borrower, and then it kind of moves out from there. Okay? And therefore, if a person fails to fulfill his obligation to pay back, the verse quoted that one who borrows and doesn't pay back is a wicked person. That's even if he has a hard time paying back, he fails to endeavor to try to obtain the funds, then he may be considered a wicked person nonetheless. Okay, but, says Rabbi Feinstein, this type of borrower, meaning a corporation that borrows, which does not place any obligation upon the person himself to pay, for though he may have a lot of money, there's no obligation on the person to pay, he does not have the positive commandment of payment, and he is not regarded as wicked for failing to pay. The prohibition of usury was not stated in this case. What he's saying is, you set up this corporation. How does this corporation work? Again, going with his approach that this is a gigantic partnership. But what are the terms and conditions of the partnership? Call it the articles of incorporation, perhaps. The articles of incorporation are that the liability is limited to the assets that are part of the corporation, which means that the corporation, when it incurs debt, that debt is never incurred upon the goof, upon the person who has stock in the company. It's set up in such a way that the debt is only on the corporation itself. So I may not recognize a corporation as an independent entity, rather as a partnership of a lot of people, but none of those people are indebting their own persons to this debt. It's just the assets that are in this partnership that are indebted, that are liable to be collected. And therefore, says Rabbi Feinstein, the prohibition of collecting interest or paying interest would not apply in such a case. Because the prohibition of interest is only where a debt is on the person. If there's no person who has the debt, it wouldn't be a problem. And therefore, he says, if you wanted to open a bank account with the bank, they're paying you interest. Who's paying you interest? The partner? No. There's no one person paying interest over there. It's just the asset paying interest. There's no prohibition of interest. This is Rabbi Feinstein's novel approach. There's no prohibition of interest where there's no person upon which the debt is placed.
Would it work the same way, the reverse way, the Jewish-owned corporation would loan out as far as would be the same kind of situation, there would not be any interest?
If the corporation would take a loan from it would be the same idea. As long as the one who's incurring the debt, as long as I can say that the one who's incurring the debt, there's no person upon whom the debt is placed, you don't incur interest. The other way around, if me, Mr. Individual, wanted to borrow money from the bank, the fact that the bank's a corporation is not going to help me because I, as the individual, am incurring the debt upon my person. Okay, so if I take a loan out from the bank, so it's very nice that the corporation is not a person, but who's incurring the debt? Me.
So you couldn't take a loan from the bank, but you could deposit savings in the bank.
Right.
Huh? And you could take a corporate loan.
Yes, you could take a corporate loan as well. That's right. You will take a corporate loan.
And you can loan money to the bank on interest.
That's right. Which is essentially what you're doing when you open a savings account. Yeah. But? Yeah, Rabbi Schwab points out there's a way around the whole question, something called the Heter Iska, which we had at Torah Tycoon's class about last year with Dan Ashkenazi. It was called the Heter Iska, which is a system whereby instead of it being a loan, it's set up as a business investment. Again, a lot of details in that. So if you, it's a widely available method and widely used method for Jewish individuals or businesses to take loans from Jewish banks without running into the interest problems.
So, I don't know if you say this kind of gets out of our discussion a little bit. You took that this theory to the next step. If you have no personal liability for a loan, we have what we call non-recourse loan. Somebody has some property, they put a mortgage on it, and say, if you're not personally liable, they have to go after the property, and that's when the liability ends. Does that mean in that case,
when I was actually looking into this response from Rabbi Feinstein,
yeah.
I actually saw someone who wrote down his response, huh? And then right after he said, "What about a non-recourse loan?" I don't remember what he said though, but he does, but he does talk about it. So I did see it discussed. I'm not sure. You can look in Rabbi Shaul Reisman's work on Rivas, is called the laws of Rivas, put up an article. He talks about it over there, chapter 5, law number 27. In the footnote, Rabbi Reisman. Yeah. Give a look over there, see if you're interested. Okay. I want to try to just, get to the point over here, the bottom line. So who's responsible in the case of Carnival, in these kinds of cases? So we're almost there. I want to just show you one more idea over here, source number 8. Again, that continues this discussion of, again, going back to Rabbi Sternbach, this is actually an error as far as the source. It's going back to the same source as source number 6. Rabbi Sternbach in Moed Muzmanim, he posits as follows, and he says it would be, with an our ability, meaning according to Torah law, to create a corporation-type structure according to Torah law within the parameters of a regular partnership, with the stipulation that there's no lien on the person or his money within this business except for what is dedicated to the business, and we do not have to make a corporation like a golem. That's the word he used. Okay, again, going back to this non-existent entity, okay, that he speaks of, that just doesn't exist. He says, you just make it a partnership with the terms that we create a corporation. Okay, so when all is said and done, the bottom line is, who is ultimately liable for these things according to Torah law? So the question we have to ask is, what is the status of the directors and the officers and the shareholders within a company? Well, the shareholders, depending on which view you take, may or may not be owners. If the shareholder is an owner, then he would be responsible for the, let's say, damage incurred by his company. See, theoretically. Again, criminal intent, I think that's obvious that whoever carried out the crime, he is responsible. The fact that he did it in the name of the corporation wouldn't absolve the person who was responsible for it. You mentioned, depending how high up the chain it goes, if it's coming from the very top or lower down, or it really came from the top and people lower down took the fall for it, and so on and so forth. But there, if it's criminal activity, certainly whoever committed the crime is responsible for it would be responsible. The question becomes where you have damages. And then you go into more monetary law, and the question is, upon whose head does responsibility for damages rest? We have different laws for a person who causes damage, for a person's assets that causes damage. Okay, the classic case in the Talmud of my ox that gores another person, or my ox that went into your field and ate your wheat, and so on and so forth. The law is different. So let's just say, let's just talk about for a moment, I have a corporation of oxen, okay, just to keep things simple over here, okay, Ox Incorporated, and I have all these oxen, I have a lot of shareholders, okay, and the shareholders have directors and officers and employees who are supposed to watch those animals, and they failed to do so, and the animals went into Farmer Joe's field next door and ate up his crop. Who is liable? The insurance company, thank you. Assuming that there is no insurance company, who is liable for the case? Okay, who's being dragged to Bezdin? Well, it would depend. Are the shareholders owners? Well, then they're the owners of these animals. If the shareholder is not an owner, if you take the approach of Rabbi Sternbach that it's the money I invested in these animals is a loan to the directors, well then the oxen would belong to the directors, and the directors happen to owe me lots of money for those oxen. Okay, so it really would depend on whom you view as the owner of the assets of the company. It would very much depend, based on that, who is responsible. Okay, and then once you get involved in that, you have to first determine who's the owner. If you're the owner, then this is your assets. If it's your assets, you're responsible for it. If the BP oil pipeline blew a gasket because someone didn't put it on properly, who's the owner of that pipeline causing all that damage? And again, is an entire tractate dedicated to figuring out these kinds of cases where you have an oil pipeline. What's your responsibility for damage caused by that pipeline? Which category of damage does it fall into? So on and so forth. That's a whole separate discussion. But for our purposes, you have to just figure out, number one, who's the owner? Once you figure out who's the owner, it starts there. And then you work your way down. If I, the shareholder, am the owner, and I hired these directors to run the company, then they are what you would call, according to Jewish law, a legal guardian, which brings us to source number 9. There are 4 types of guardians. And one of them is a paid watchman. A paid watchman means if I hire you to work for me, and you're responsible for it, you are a paid guardian. So now you as a director are my employee, so then the responsibility may well rest with you as my hired hand. If he went ahead and hired employees, then going down the chain, you would just follow it along to see ultimately who's responsible according to Jewish law, but it would fall into those kinds of categories. Okay? So really the big question would be in terms of responsibility, financial responsibility, who is the owner of this item? Okay, that's where the question would come in.
Any questions? Comments?
Ultimately, nowadays, in an environment that people do business in pre-existing corporate law, and you're coming in, you're buying, you're setting up a corporation with the minimum levels, with the law, wouldn't that be the presumption that would you follow that?
According to Rabbi Sternbach, no. In other words, if you were to go to a Bezdin, according to his position, they wouldn't recognize the whole corporation in the first place. According to the other opinions, I would venture to say that yes, I mean, they're looking at you as owners. As an owner of the corporation, if the law of the land limits your liability, so then yes, you probably, according to law of the land law, you would probably have limited liability just based on the fact that that's the law of the land. So to the extent that we recognize there's a partnership over here, the law of the land would kick in. What? Again, yeah, I'm not sure exactly how things would work out over there. You mentioned, Rabbi Schwab mentioned an idea called Minigas Leishman, meaning when you have a custom in the marketplace, that may become the presumed default status, even if it's not specified, even though even if normally it's not the Torah law. If it's how things work in the marketplace in which you are doing business, that's assumed. I think we did a class a few years ago on bankruptcy, and the question was, according to Torah law, and this is really a big corporation question, if you file for bankruptcy, so now everyone is off the hook. Torah law doesn't recognize this notion of bankruptcy as absolving you of all your debts. But I think, if I recall correctly, one of the ideas posted was that in the marketplace today, when I invest money with you, I'm doing so knowing that the marketplace has this notion called bankruptcy, and that will automatically kick in, even though Torah law doesn't recognize it. But I'm doing it with the understanding and the knowledge that this is how the marketplace works, so I have to play by those rules. Okay, so, possibly over here as well, those ideas would kick in as well. But again, going back to my disclaimer, I'm talking about a situation, a scenario where you don't have law of the land in place or other market rules in place. But yes, obviously those would play a major factor. According to Rabbi Sternbuch, again, just to reiterate, according to Rabbi Sternbuch, despite law of the land, there's really not much to talk about in those terms.
Is the halakhic world at peace with Israeli limited liability company?
No. Yes and no. There's a lot of talk, and my understanding is that, in fact, the Israeli halakhic authorities don't, by and large, don't agree with Rabbi Feinstein's position on the interest question either. And so, and many, many banks whom the Torah observer community do business with have what Rabbi Schwab alluded to earlier, the heter iska, that it creates as an investment. I know that when I lived in Lakewood, New Jersey, there was a lot of talk about certain banks that had Jews old controlling shares. They tried. I do seem to recall one bank where they said they tried to set it up and it didn't happen, and they were warning people, like, you really have to ask a qualified rabbi what to do before opening up an account with this bank, doing any business with them, because it runs into problems. In these kinds of things. So yeah, these questions, but it's not a new problem. These issues have been going on for decades, not centuries, and therefore they've been dealt with, and more often than not, they already have structures in place to allow the business world to function, even with these challenges.
Do you consult a rabbi before you take the loan, or before you pay it back?
Before you take the loan. You should be doing it before you take the loan. Yeah. I once had to close a credit card because I found out that the credit card was owned a controlling share by a Jewish individual. And I had to close it out for that reason. Huh? I'm not telling you. Okay, I remember.
As an interesting aside, the Aronson family, who owns Carnival Cruise Lines, also has a controlling stake in Bank of Hapoalim, which they've been in a lot of trouble for. So they may not be persona non grata in Israel.
Thank you. All right, thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you very much.